future-proof gold.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. We have a special show for you this week. We're going to be trying to find a definitive answer to one of life's most fundamental question. Where are we? You can contact the show, science@newstalk.com. We're on Twitter, @NewsTalkScience. You can also text us for 30 cent 53106. First, though, I'm joined in studio by double Dr. Laura Dungan and physicist and assistant professor in science education at UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Now, usually we would start with this week's science stories, but Laura and Shane do not know that that's not what we're going to be doing this week.
Yeah.
What?
It is the 4th of May, 1769. Our producer, Aidan McKelvey, has, at great expense to News Talk and through the highest of production values, sent the three of us back in time. We're on the deck of Captain James Cook's HMB Endeavour on his first voyage in the South Pacific. And the primary mission of the Endeavour is to observe the transit of Venus and explore what is a largely unknown area to Europeans at this time. Now, I know this much was going to happen, right? But after this, I'm completely in the dark, as you are. I have in my hand an envelope that my producer handed to me on the way into the studio. And it says, top secret, only to be opened once the show has begun.
Oh, God.
Ooh, this is exciting.
And this is exciting.
I love Captain Cook.
Did we do all that research for nothing?
I'm afraid you did. That was a red herring.
That's just like our
Stop
PhD.
Pretending you did loads of research. So
I did 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Here we are.
Oh, God, what is this?
So, you're alone on the deck of the HMB Endeavour somewhere in the South Pacific. We have furnished you with the following instruments.
Okay.
A sextant, which is like a protractor with a sight. It measures the angle between two visible objects.
Oh, she has a pen. She's cheating.
No, I'm good. Actually writing these down.
A chronometer. This is basically a clock set to Greenwich Mean Time, and a compass.
Okay.
So we're to use these three devices to pinpoint our location on Earth. Oh, my God. Once you have figured out how this can be done, you will describe your methodological approach for the listeners. Achieving this feat will redound greatly to the honour of this show, as well as the dignity of all those who take part in it, and may tend greatly to the advancement of the prospective careers as marine navigators. Okay, so we're on a boat in the South Pacific. We have a sextant, a chronometer, and a compass. We have to pinpoint our location on Earth.
I thought a sextant and a compass were the same thing.
We're going to die.
Okay. We're definitely. Okay. Do we have fresh water? Can I eat
we
Shane?
We have fresh water. We don't need to eat Shane just yet. Okay, so.
Just yet.
So if we're on a boat and we want to pinpoint our location on Earth.
Stars.
We have to use the stars.
Is it nighttime? It sounds like nighttime.
Oh, it's not nighttime.
Oh, the sun?
You can use the
okay,
sun.
But the chronometer tells us what time of day it is, so then
okay.
We should know from that based on where the sun is, we should know what's north, south, east, and west.
Yes.
Oh, no, wait, we have a compass. We could have just done that with the compass.
We know how yeah. high the sun
but
is
then,
in the
But
sky.
If we have the compass,
yeah.
we can then know where the sun is and then where we're going relative to
oh,
the
so
sun.
Oh, so we know where north, south, east, or west is, but we just have no idea where we are in the entire world. Is
yeah.
that the plan? Do we know where we left from and how long ago?
The time on the chronometer is Greenwich Mean Time.
Oh, so it's not the time where we are then. Okay, so it's like 12 o'clock in London, and we're somewhere in the South Pacific.
No, we just know what time it is in London. We don't know
okay,
what
so
it
wait,
says.
If we know it's 12 o'clock in London, mm-hmm. then we can see by where the sun is.
Based on the compass.
We know what time it is based on where the sun is.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly, relative to that. And then the height of the sun and the sky will give us a position.
Bloody hell.
Get wow. Take cover.
We're trying to concentrate.
Oh, my God.
Who's dinner?
It's just like Grafton Street at midnight after a bag of chips.
So, okay, so that's it. So if we know
also,
what time it is.
What do you mean the height of the sun? What are you talking about,
I have
Shane?
A very important point.
Oh, okay.
If we can hear seagulls, we're near land.
Yes! Can we just start swimming? I don't swim very well.
That's a good point. Okay, or unless they've come out to die.
Oh, okay. So
oh, is that actually
happens.
A thing?
If we hear it, then we're in trouble.
Shane, what do you mean by the height of the sun?
So I think at 12 o'clock, right, mm-hmm. the sun should be, if you're at the equator, it should be exactly like at the top of the sky, right? Like,
yeah.
you know, right above you.
Yeah.
And deviation from that will tell you how far you are in terms of, is it latitude?
Oh.
Like how far down you are from the equator or above it you are.
So we've used the compass to see what time it is now.
Mm-hmm.
We're assuming, let's just say it's midday now for us. We don't know what time it is in London, but it's now our midday.
No, we know what time it is.
We know what time it is in London, but we've now used that to work out that it's midday where we are. It has to be some sort of time.
Perfect. All right. Yeah.
So it's midday. So Shane has just told
us. You're the physicist here.
You really are the only hope we have.
Yeah, I feel there's a lot of pressure.
I mean, there is.
He's like, I put a dicky bow on this morning. I don't need to do anything else.
I'm kind of wondering, am I going to wake up now in a moment? So I think if you use your sextant, you can measure the angle of the sun in the sky, right? So
exactly.
And if you know the time and you know the angle, you know how far you are deviated from the equator. Do you know what I mean?
Or Greenwich Mean. Greenwich Mean Time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true.
The line of Greenwich. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that line. Yeah, so the longitude line.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So if we have that as a constant and we measure the angle that we have gone
line.
Away and the time.
Mm.
So then we can pin. So we've done the equator from the sextant, so we know how far north or south we are. We know how far we are from Greenwich Time, which tells us how far left or right, give me it, east or west we are.
Okay, so now we have a point.
So we have a point. So we're done.
So we know we are.
Does that count?
I think
we did. We win?
Aidan, who has set this whole thing up, is sort of shaking his head. So either he is on the boat and sort of wobbling around.
I think he's about to vomit.
I think he reckons that scientists in Ireland have a far better training than Mara and I actually have had. You know?
I haven't actually been a proper scientist in years as well. I'm just a doctor. We do nothing.
I've loads of fun facts about Captain Cook, but I'm sure none of these are relevant right now.
We're going to die out here, so you should probably start telling them.
So how do we do east-west?
So east-west, we're going to say we have a clock which tells us Greenwich Mean Time. And we're going to use our sun to tell us what time it is now with us here. So we can tell how far we are from Greenwich Mean Time. Wouldn't that be fair? So by the number of hours we are from Greenwich Mean Time, we can assess how far east or west of London we are.
Yeah.
So now we have our latitude.
Yes.
What did we find it the first time?
Longitude.
Okay, so now we have latitude.
Yeah, except...
That's pretty good. I'm glad. I think I contributed a lot to this.
Do we sort of know where we are?
I think so.
I
don't know.
I think we're... Do you know what? I think we're not bad. Let's find out, shall we, how we would actually do this. Vanessa Collingridge is an author, broadcaster, and doctor of historical cartography. She joins me now to set us straight. Vanessa, how are you?
I am very good, and I have very much enjoyed listening unwittingly. Just gone on. It was absolute genius. Thank you very much for expressions like the top of the sky.
Oh,
no. The news forevermore. I think you guys did really, really well, considering that was sprung on top of you.
My palms are sweating right now.
Well, I'm really surprised. The physicist didn't really add that much. Neither did the broadcaster, really.
The one module I refused to teach when I was teaching physics in Trinity College was anything to do with relative positions in the sky.
So Vanessa, tell us a little bit about this journey, because there was a real mission, Captain Cook's voyage in the South Pacific, and he was handed an envelope, right?
He really was handed a secret envelope with a second set of orders in. But first, he was sent out halfway across the world to go and measure this astronomical event called the transit of Venus, which was to determine the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And when that was done, and we can talk about that in a minute, he was handed this secret set of orders from the Admiralty, which he opened up just before he left the island of Tahiti, where he'd been doing the observations. And this said, you are now to go down to 40 degrees south and search for the mythical Great Southern Continent. And they didn't really know it was mythical. They believed it was actually something in existence. They believed at this time that the Great Southern Continent was an enormous continent that stretched right the way across the south of the globe that would be like finding another Asia. It would make whoever discovered it the richest nation on Earth.
So along this way, it would have been pretty important for Captain Cook to figure out where he was on the globe. How did we do, and how would you actually position oneself on the globe with a sextant, a chronometer and a compass 250 years ago?
Okay, well, there was a little bit of swapping around between what's latitude and what's longitude. So let's start with latitude first. So obviously, you know that the Earth is a sphere. And in the past, we used to know where we were by experience, just by, you know, knowing, because we didn't really move very far, Or if we did go out sailing, we'd go and hug the coastline. But when you want to go further afield, how on earth do you do that? How do you sail out of sight of land and get back home again? So this is where, you know, Lara and Shane are absolutely right. You need to determine your position using a grid line of latitude and longitude. So latitudes are the horizontal lines spreading north and south from the equator, which is
basically... you were wrong.
So it's your baseline. You did get the equator, and you got the equator being at 0 degrees, but it's 0 degrees latitude. And actually, you did that part of it really pretty well. You can use your sextant, which is basically essentially like a protractor, to measure the angle between the horizon and celestial objects, such as the noonday sun or the pole star Polaris.
Yes.
And this sextant uses a really, really clever system of double reflecting mirrors, which means you only look through one sight, one hole, and you get a split screen with the horizon on one side and the sun, star, whatever you're using, on the other side. And you then shift the arm of the sextant until the two images line up and you've got the sun actually touching the horizon. You then look down, read the scale at the base of the sextant, and that gives you the angular height of the sun or the star above the horizon. In other words, that gives you your latitude measured in degrees. Now, if you don't know the exact time of where you are, you would do that experiment. And again, you got this bit right. You do this measurement at noon when the sun is at its highest point in the sky. But how do you find out where noon is? Well, as you say, you use your compass. And when you think about the sun moving, it rises in the east, it goes in a nice big arc and sets in the west. At the highest point of that arc, the top of the sky,
top
I think,
of the sky.
That is the technical term, actually, yes.
Is due south. And you can, of course, measure that off on your compass. So when your sun is at due south, when it's sort of lining up with due south, that is when you would be essentially having your local time noon.
Right. So and that makes sense because the sun rises in the east, sets in the west. That means... at midnight, it's right underneath the horizon as far as it'll go. And at midday, it's at the very top
of the sky. Of the sky.
Love it. Yeah, so all that sounds really, really simple, doesn't it? But of course, nothing in life is ever that simple. For a start, you're trying to do this sometimes on, you know, pretty bad weather on the ship's deck. It's, you know, a lot of movement happening. I've tried to do this. It is nigh on impossible for someone like me. Fair enough, Cook had a lot of experience, but I was utterly useless when I crewed the Endeavour replica and tried to redo this. And it really is quite challenging. So you have my sympathy being just thrown into the water and expected to do this. Okay, but it's more complicated than that, as well as all these kind of practical problems of not being able to see the sun or the stars because it's too cloudy or the sea's all bumpy and stormy. There are also some theoretical problems because this only really works in spring or autumn at the equinox. Away from the equinox, because of course the Earth is tilting on its axis throughout the year. So at the winter solstice, you have to adjust this by -23.45 degrees. And the summer solstice, you have to add 23.45 degrees and then adjust this throughout the year.
Shane is nodding along here
totally
like, oh yeah,
knew
I knew that.
No, yeah. This is why I didn't want to teach it.
Yeah.
What Cook wouldn't have known, because we've only relatively recently learned this as well, is that you also need to adjust for something called refraction too, or the bending of the light as it goes through the atmosphere. Sometimes the atmosphere is more dense in some places and other times. And the more dense the atmosphere, the more refraction of the light that you'll get as well. So all in all, latitude looks simple, isn't really. But don't worry, it gets even worse with longitude. Of course, latitude only tells you half of the story of where you are. That's how far north or south. As you rightly said, although not always using the right expression, you also need to know how far east or west you are. And that's determined by your longitude. So longitude are the imaginary lines running from the North Pole to the South Pole, or South Pole to the North Pole. They basically go around like the segments of an orange. And these lines radiate east and west from a chosen 0 degree line, which Britain adopted in the 18th century as stemming from the Royal Observatory at Greenwich.
I was only there last week.
Oh, it's a fantastic place. Absolutely amazing. I took one of my kids down last year. And of course, Greenwich Mean Time, or Greenwich, was sort of designated by the international community as the 0° line of longitude in 1884. But in Cook's day, you had the prime meridian for the British being London, you had the prime meridian for the French being Paris, and it was all a bit chaotic and haphazard. But it got even more complicated, because really until the second half of the 18th century, determining your longitude was really, really problematic for navigators. And this meant that most maps were completely unreliable for accurate navigation. You could go out, sail into the middle of the ocean, discover something, come back, and nobody would ever find it again because you put it in the wrong place. Not only that, you were highly likely to grossly miscalculate your longitude and get shipwrecked. The famous one is 1707, when Sir Cloudesley Shovel died on the way back from seeing action in the Mediterranean. And he wrecked 4 ships out of about 21 on the Scilly Isles. They thought they were safely home from the Mediterranean, and they weren't. They thought they were just off Brittany. Actually, they were on the Scilly Islands, and 2,000 people died, 2,000 sailors died. And it was that disaster that was profoundly shocking and resulted in the 1714 Longitude Act that then launched this kind of longitude prize that eventually John Harrison and his chronometer ended up winning, although he had a long journey to get there as well. So you got the Greenwich Mean Time, and then you worked out the important part, hooray, which was if you know what the time is at Greenwich, you can then work out your time in the local time, your local noon, and by doing that, you can then translate time back into distance. You know that 360° the Earth spins in one day, it spins in 24 hours. So 360° divided by 24 is 15. So each 15° of longitude away from Greenwich is an hour. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm talking to you from Glasgow, which is 4.2° west of Greenwich. So my midday here will be around 16 or so minutes after noon at Greenwich, and you're in Dublin, which is 6.2° west longitude of Greenwich. So your noon will be around 24 minutes after noon in Greenwich.
So we used to have Dublin time. There's Dublin Standard Time, and Dunsink Observatory in Dublin is where time was. I suppose it was our Greenwich, and there still is a lot of the equipment out there in Dunsink. It's not an abandoned, but it's not in the prime anymore. And Dublin time was the standard time here, a half hour away from Greenwich.
Yeah.
And Bristol time, of course, the famous one was about 20 minutes behind London as well.
That's right. Yes. Now, all of this means that we were fine until we all started travelling. But when you start travelling, it causes problems. You can no longer rely on your local time. You've got to synchronise local time, which is why you need to start thinking in whole world grids. So that's why you need a kind of whole world system. Mm. That's why when you had the railway starting up, it completely screwed up times, the way we kept time all around Britain, because suddenly if you've got a fast train going from London to Cornwall,
it's going back in time.
It's going, yeah.
So Vanessa, that's helped us map where we are in the globe, but actually this particular voyage was undertaken in the hope of helping us to map the solar system better, right? How exactly is that? What has the transit of Venus got to do with anything, and how did that knowledge help us?
Okay, so the transit of Venus was a really, really important but very rare event. So this, essentially, as it says, is an astronomical event where the planet Venus passes or transit across the face or the disk of the sun. And this event is visible from Earth. It happens once every 100 years, then there's a second transit roughly 8 years after that, and then you've got to wait another 100 years. Now, this was really important in the 18th century because you're trying to get really accurate measurements for the Earth, for the solar system, precisely to help navigation. Because without this kind of map or sort of huge celestial clock, you can't work out where you are. Mm. So this was really the holy grail of astronomy to a large extent. It was first predicted by the astronomer Johannes Kepler in about the 1600s, and then in 1716 by the astronomer royal Edmund Halley. Now, he knew it would occur in 1761 and 1769, but he was already 60 years old, so he knew he would be dead by then, basically. So he made the Royal Society of Great Britain to promise to do observations. Now, why was this so important? Well, as I said, by the 1600s, Kepler had calculated the relative positions of planets in our solar system using the Earth's sun distance as the astronomical distance. But the transit of Venus, this rare astronomical event, was a chance to work out absolute distance. So the absolute distance between the Earth and the sun. And from that distance, that would then allow a host of other accurate measurements right across the solar system and also on Earth.
How exactly, Vanessa? So we want to know exactly how far something is away from us. We see the movement of a planet like Venus. How does that give us an idea of distant planets and their exact distance away from us?
Junior cycle trigonometry, Jonathan, can help you do this.
Right.
Yeah, so you can use the triangles, basically. And you can measure, if you know the distance between two points, so they needed two people to measure this transit at the same time, and they knew how far apart they were from each other, and looking at angles then at when the transit started and when it ended, they were able to calculate the length of all sides of the triangle. Is that right, Vanessa?
That is genius, Shane. Well done. That is perfect.
You're back in the game.
Back in the
credibility.
Game.
Credibility.
That's exactly the point. So Cook was sent down to Tahiti, and he was sent there to observe the moment Venus made contact with the sun and then transited across the face of the sun and then left the sun. And that gives you a kind of one set of angles, if you like. And that was a 6-hour astronomical observation. But it wasn't just him. There were other observers all around the world. There were also observers, for example, in Norway, in North Cape, Norway, and in Hudson Bay. And on Earth, you knew the distance between those observers. So exactly what Shane is saying, you can use that known distance and your angles for a clever bit of trigonometry to work out the other distances in your big triangles.
So Vanessa, you've told us how we know where we are on the planet and how we can figure out where the planet is in the solar system. But I have a challenge for you. Have you any idea how you would go about pinpointing our galaxy's position in the ever-moving universe?
That's really easy. The answer is no. No, I'm an Earth scientist, for goodness sake. I'm very comfortable on Earth. I'm just about within my comfort zone when I'm talking about the sun and Venus and the moon and stars. Anything beyond that, and I am completely clueless. I cannot tell you what's above and beyond.
Well, it was probably unfair to throw that at you unplanned, Vanessa, but you did it to Shane and Lara. I know someone who might be able to give us a little bit more of an idea on that question. Her name is Hélène Courtois. For the moment, Shane Bergen, Lara Duggan and Vanessa Collingridge, thank you very much. Up next, how to pinpoint our place in the universe. Yes, you're welcome back. Now, when I was a teenager, I was a pen pal with some boarding school girls in London, and I used to send letters back and forth, and I remember very distinctly I sent a letter addressed to the girl in question's name at the boarding school in the county she was in England, in Europe, in the world, in the Milky Way. And I thought that was, you know, that was a pretty good concise summary of where they were, and it was a bit of a gag, but I missed out a line. It seems that there is one or two more lines we might add to that address. And here to help us find them is Hélène Courtois. She's professor of astrophysics at the University of Lyon and author of Finding Our Place in the Universe. Welcome to the program, Hélène.
Thank you very much. Hello.
So perhaps you might start off with this idea of where we are at the moment. So maybe you might tell me about what we know about where you are right this minute.
Okay, so I am in Lyon, which is a city on planet Earth. This planet is orbiting a star, which is called the Sun. The Sun is one of 200 billion stars in a galaxy, which we call the Milky Way. And our galaxy doesn't live alone in the universe. Actually, it lives in a group of galaxies, which we call, in a very boring way, the local group. But the local group is not the biggest structure in the universe. Our galaxy is embedded in a supercluster of galaxies.
A supercluster.
Yeah. And a supercluster, this is what we have discovered in 2014. We named it Laniakea. And then it's the universe.
We'll go through that one by one then, shall we? So obviously people are familiar that the Earth revolves around the sun, and the sun is in the Milky Way. Now, I didn't realize the Milky Way had so many stars. Did you say
200 billion.
200 billion stars.
Yes. So actually, I like to say 200 billion worlds, because now each time we almost each star that we observe, we find planets around. Not all of them, but really we are looking at worlds when we look at a star. So maybe in our galaxy, there are 200 billion worlds.
Which is crazy to think about. I mean, I knew it was a lot, but I didn't realize it was so many. So you have all of these amazing worlds. And they form a shape. Can you talk to us about the shape that the yes. galaxy, the Milky Way, forms and other types of galaxies? Because there are different shapes that these structures can form.
Sure, but our galaxy is the most beautiful one, for once. Like our planet is the most amazing one. So our galaxy looks like a spiral galaxy. It's very blue and goldy. It's a very beautiful object, but yet we don't have a photo of it because we have never sent a camera outside our solar system. But we know it looks like this because we have been observing the shapes of stars in the sky, and also because we observe a lot of the universe and they all look the same, all galaxies in the universe. You are right that there are two big families of galaxies, spirals and ellipticals. But the ellipticals, they are much more boring. They are just orange balls of stars.
So how do we know we're in a spiral galaxy? Because as you say, you can't photograph it from here. All we can see is what's outside. We can't take a photograph of it from the outside.
Yes, so what we do is we take photographs from inside, and actually the photograph shows that there are structures like stars, like the sun, actually lives in groups, and we can see spiral arms. Like the photos of the sky don't show an uniform pattern of stars. Actually, stars are clustered, and then there are empty structures, and then we see clouds of interstellar matter. So from inside, even if you can't see the galaxy from outside, from inside we can distinguish a certain number of spiral arms.
So what is driving this shape at the center, and how does the galaxy itself move around in the space around it?
Mm-hmm. So the galaxy is rotating on itself. So actually our star, the sun and the planet also, we have already done 17 times. We have been rotating around the central point of the galaxy, which is probably a supermassive black hole. So the galaxy is rotating as a pinwheel, if you like. So this is really what it looks like, and the rotation is quite fast. We rotate at 220 kilometers per second. So since we started this interview, every second we have been moving 220 kilometers with the sun in the galaxy. And the galaxy itself is moving in the universe. So everything is moving. There is nothing static in the universe. Moon is rotating around the planet Earth. Earth is rotating around the sun. Sun is rotating inside the galaxy. And actually, our galaxy has a large motion, very fast in the universe towards a very specific location.
So we have this spiral galaxy moving around in the universe. And then above that, we have the local group. How do we know that the local group is there?
Yes, so we can look at other galaxies around us. Actually, this is what we do, us. Cosmographers are the people who are doing cartography of the cosmos, like geographers. We just do cosmography. So we measure the distance to other galaxies around us, but not only we don't make only static maps, we measure distance and displacement of the galaxies around us. And then we can know from this if we are in the same group and if we move along in a coherent manner. So it's like if you are looking at a river, and you don't see if water is flowing to the right or to the left. If you throw a bunch of leaves on the river, then you will know if they are all together and where they are going. So this is what we do. We look at the galaxies around us, and we see if they have a coherent motion similar to our own galaxy.
So the challenge here, of course, is we're now getting to not just the 200 billion stars in our galaxy, but of course the galaxies that exist in the local group, which presumably are a multiple of that. How on earth do we process all the data to make accurate visual models at this sort of level? Because there are too many points to be looking at. And of course, the other challenge is everything's moving. So how do you measure the speed of something when you're also moving, possibly at another angle in 3D space?
Yes, you are right. It's quite complex. So what we do, we take telescopes first. We use telescopes to measure the distances and the displacement of other galaxies than ours. And then, as you are saying, you are totally right, we need a reference frame to measure our velocity. For example, if you are in a train, and you are walking in the train, maybe you are walking at 3 kilometers an hour. This is a normal pace. But actually, the train could be like a French TGV, would be going at 300 kilometers per hour. So what is your real speed? Is it 300 kilometers per hour? Or are you walking at 3 kilometers per hour? Actually, you are walking at 3 kilometers per hour. I'm sure you don't walk at 300 kilometers per hour. Yeah. So this is the same. For galaxies, we need a frame. And we need a frame which is static so that we can measure our velocity compared to this frame. And so we are like in a train, actually. The universe is expanding, but we really want to measure how fast is our motion away from this expansion. We don't care too much about the train velocity. And we do this by looking at what we call the cosmic microwave background. It's a radiation coming from just after the Big Bang. It's a very old radiation, which is how can I say it? Those are the walls in a room, and you can check your velocity against this wall. So right. It's a static frame.
So the thing I'm really interested in, because people have seen spiral galaxies, I'm sure, those photographs have been everywhere. But when I saw the model of Lanikea, I was stunned for a second, not only because it was so beautiful, but also because it's so unlike any other structure we see in outer space.
Yes, yes.
You can see a picture of this up on our Twitter, so twitter.com/newstalkscience. But actually, if you can use all of your descriptive powers to make this visual for people, Helene, because it is not a spiral.
Yes.
In fact, it almost looks like a long feather of some sort. Can you describe how these galaxies inside these larger groups are structured in the wider universe?
Yes. So you have to understand that when we talk about superclusters or the architecture of the universe, each galaxy, each spiral containing 200 billion stars like the Sun are just little dots at this scale.
Yeah.
And what we see when we make our maps, it's the rivers of matter that those galaxies are flying on. So actually, we can see like a necklace of pearls, and those pearls are the galaxies, and they move along those necklaces. So when we look at the map that we have made by observing all these motions, they look like at 5 rivers which are feeding a central region, which we call the Great Attractor. And the galaxies, including our galaxy, the Milky Way, is one of those little bright spots in this very dark universe, flying onto those rivers going towards the Great Attractor.
That's a great sort of example. If you imagine, and the graphic sort of shows this super bright sort of set of almost tributaries with sort of clumps along it, almost like the branches of a tree in some respect, but sort of longer. The pearl necklace is a really good sort of visual description of it.
Yes.
It's probably the first thing that doesn't form that sort of round shape that we see so often in both nature and in space.
Yes, I think it looks very organic to me too. It's like a neuronal network in a brain, or it's also where you have neuronal network.
Yeah.
Something like this.
Do you know what, Helene? I'll be honest with you. Like, I am an atheist and I don't believe in a god or a higher power or anything like that. But when I saw this structure,
I
had to pause for a second and think, like, what is that? I mean, it looks like something organic, like a vein. It seems like it's part of an organic living thing, which, of course, it can't be. Right, well, we're going to take a break now and let you take a look on Twitter. So if you go to Twitter, twitter.com/newstalkscience, you can see a picture of Lanike. And let me know if you see what I see. It is absolutely beautiful and unlike anything I've ever seen when we think about solar systems, nebulae, galaxies. It's just really different. After the break, we'll be asking just what is the great attractor? Yes, welcome back to this very special episode of Future Proof, where we're asking where we are and how we know that. We've progressed to the most macro scale imaginable and are talking about the supercluster in which the Milky Way, our galaxy, resides. It's called Lanikea. Helene, you touched on it earlier, but what exactly is the great attractor?
It's really like what you said. When we look at it, for us, we call this, for example, the art of Lanikea, the great attractor. And those rivers of galaxies flying towards this place, it's like arteries or veins going to the heart of Lanikea. So this place is nothing really mysterious about. It's a big concentration of mass, probably a lot of galaxies. But the funny thing about this is that we will never be able to observe it. So it's very mysterious for us. This is how I started my career. I was a student at the university in Lyon in physics. And one of my professors told me about the great attractor. And I have been attracted by this field of research since I was 22 now. So great attractor is a special place in the universe that we can't observe. Because of our own galaxy, it's like if you want to see your neighbor, but you have in front of you a big tree, and this big tree is masking, the window of the living room of your neighbor. You will never see your neighbor watching his TV. So
I wish there was a tree in between me and my neighbor.
So this is the point. We have our own galaxy, the spiral arms that we were describing before, and particularly the center of our galaxy is a big bulge with many, many billions of stars. And this is in front of us. And the great attractor is just beyond this in space, not right after our galaxy. It's far away, but it's masked to our view. So this is why it's so mysterious. It's not mysterious maybe in what causes the motions, because we know in physics motions are caused by gravity at this kind of scales. It's just the mass of a galaxy attracted by another mass that makes galaxies flow in the universe.
There are no other forces at play at something this size. It's just gravity and the expansion of the universe.
Yes, exactly. So it's a competition between the two, because if you had only gravity, the whole universe would be a big ball of matter, totally like not structured at all. If you had only expansion, everything would be dissipated. And what we see, and it's really an observation, it's not a simulation by computer. What we see, the maps, it's a sculpture sculpted by gravity and expansion in competition. One is trying to pull everything together. The other one wants to push everything away. So because there is competition, in certain places, gravitation wins. So galaxies can collide, can fusion. This is the life of galaxies. Mm. And in other places, everything dissipates and galaxies fly away from each other. So the size of our Milky Way is 100 light years across. So the Milky Way is 100 light years across. This means that if you travel at the speed of light, it takes you 100,000 years to cross the Milky Way. It's 100,000 light years across. But the maps that we are looking at are 1 billion light years across. This is huge. So you have to understand that above the scale of a galaxy, which is just a little dot on our maps, galaxies are not distributed randomly in the universe. If I tell you, draw me the universe, actually you should have an image of little villages, which are the groups of galaxies, with small country roads, rivers of galaxies flying into these groups. And then you have larger cities that we call clusters of galaxies, where you have maybe 1,500 galaxies. In groups, we have a few tens. We live Milky Way, Andromeda. We live in a small group with maybe 30, 50 galaxies. We discover more of them every day, almost. And then you have these country roads, you have highways going to clusters of galaxies, and you have the center of a supercluster, which is like New York, LA, I don't know, a very big city, and those are the super big highways. And you can see, when you measure motions of galaxies like me, that galaxies don't fly at the same speed. It's when you are on a country road, you drive slowly, you go to your village. When you are going to the city, you are a bit more on a hurry and everybody is driving, so there are more cars. And when you are on a super big highway, actually the velocity is much faster and everybody goes in the same direction. If someone is not going in the same direction, it makes a big problem. It's the same with the galaxies. When we are on these very big highways, so what you were describing earlier, the rivers or the necklace, all this architecture, it's a dynamic architecture. And there is motion, and galaxies are flying on top of those rivers.
Where does dark matter and dark energy fit into this model of the universe as we see it?
So what we call dark matter and dark energy, first, I don't like those two names, so I want to explain to the listeners why. So actually, when we compute the velocity or speed of a galaxy, and that we compute how much mass is attracting it, because we can see over galaxies, we see that we are missing 5 times more mass than what we count in terms of galaxies. So I can see that there is not enough mass attracting, for example, the Milky Way. But if I put 5 times more, then my computation is all right. So this is what is written usually as dark matter. There is something more in the universe that we are not able to see. So I prefer to say that it's invisible matter or transparent matter. And I explain why. It's because for a physicist, if there is dark matter, I can see it actually because it's blocking light. While here, I can see through, I can count the number of galaxies in front of me, and I can compute the attraction force, the gravity, and I'm missing mass 5 times more. So at the moment, there is a theory, which is there are two main ideas. Or it's a matter which is an exotic matter, we don't know what kind of particles, and there is lots of it in the universe, or we are wrong on our way of writing the equations of gravity. They are called the general relativity, those equations. And if we just tweak them a little bit, actually we don't need this incredible invisible matter. So as at the moment when we speak, I think it's a 50-50 in the physicist. Wow. And we just need more experiments.
That would be quite the experiment to prove that dark matter didn't exist. That would be something extraordinary.
Yes, so this is why now we have all these experiments on gravitational waves, for example. We need to understand gravity. It's the 21st century question.
The last question I wanted to ask you was, do we have any idea, Ellen, what is at the center of our supercluster? What could possibly be driving the movement at this level?
Yes. So very recently, since January, actually, we have just published a map which is twice the size of the map that allowed us to discover our own supercluster. And now we can see other supercluster neighbors. So we can look at their center, and what we see, it's a big bunch of galaxies. So we can see the image like the Laniakea image with rivers. We see others now, for example, Perseus species supercluster, Coma supercluster, Shapley supercluster. So we have neighbors. We can look at their center, and we can see beautiful clusters of galaxies. So a bunch of many cities of galaxies, and this is probably what looks like our own center, which is called the Great Attractor.
It's been wonderful speaking with you, Hélène. You've explained all of that so vividly. I can see it in my mind's eye. Thank you so much for joining us. Hélène Courtois is author of Finding Our Place in the Universe. She's professor of astrophysics at the University of Lyon as well. Hélène, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Let me know what you made of that. And in particular, if you saw this picture of Laniakea, like what was the first thing that came to your mind? You can text us in 53106 for 30 cent. That's it from us for this week. Hope you enjoyed the programme. Aidan McKelvey was producing. Simon Keane was researching. Peter Molloy was on sound. Have a great weekend.
Future Proof Gold
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.